डू यू एवर क्राई? यस, व्हेनेवर आई लुक एट यू. यू मे नॉट सी माय टीयर्स, यू मे नॉट हियर माय क्राई, बट ऑलवेज व्हेन आई लुक एट यू, द क्राई इज देयर. Because of that, I go on working on you. It is not only to help you come out of your misery, it is to help myself also. If you come out of your misery, I will come out of my misery that is created by your misery. It is said that when Buddha reached to the ultimate door, he stopped there. He won't enter in. The door was opened. The devas, the gods were ready to welcome him in. But he won't enter. The devas asked him, "Why are you standing there? Come in, and we have been waiting for you since ages, and you are welcome. You have returned home." Buddha said, "I will stay here. I will have to stay here until the last human being passes by me and enters the door. I cannot enter." This is a beautiful parable. Don't take it literally, but it is true. Once you become aware, once you become a being, once you are, infinite compassion arises in you. Buddha has made compassion the criterion of enlightenment. Once you have attained, now you don't suffer for yourself, but you suffer for others. Seeing the misery all around and seeing the whole absurdity of it, seeing the possibility that you can come out of it immediately right now, and still you go on clinging. By one hand you push it away, by another hand you pull it close. You go on creating your own prisons. And how much you would like to be freed. And your whole effort is just contradictory. You want to come to the east and you go towards the west. Seeing you, yes, I always cry. The second question: for 10 years I have identified myself as a poet, but since I took sannyas 10 days ago, it has become unimportant to me whether or not I ever write another verse. Even though I have often heard you praise the poet, what has happened? First thing, you cannot be identified as being a poet. Because the poetry is something that happens only when you are not there. If you are there, it will be just rubbish. It happens only when you are absent. That's why it is so beautiful. It comes into your emptiness. It fills you. Your vacuum. You become pregnant with the unknown, with the strange. The poet is just a mother. The mother is not going to produce the child. The child has been conceived. At the most, the mother is tending it, caring deep within her heart, trying to give it a body, not the soul. Poetry comes to you just like a child is conceived, in deep love, in deep receptivity. You become a womb, and the poetry is conceived. It is a pregnancy. And one has to be very careful, because miscarriage is always possible. You can abort. You can be too much in a hurry, and you can destroy. Allow it to settle within your being. It will take its own time. It will grow by and by. It will grow in your unconscious. Your conscious is not needed. Your conscious will be an interference. You forget about it. Let it grow. You will feel heavy. Your whole being will be as if carrying a burden. Nice, pleasant, but still a burden. And one day, the child is born. In that moment, only the child is not born, the mother is also born. When the poetry is born, then the poet is born. It is not the poet who writes the poetry. In fact, it is the birth of poetry which creates the poet. You were not a poet before it. Only by its birth. The woman becomes the mother. The mother is a totally different category than an ordinary woman. A woman is a woman. Mother is totally different. She has conceived something of the beyond. She has carried the beyond into her womb. And she has given it a body. The poet is born when the poetry is born. It is a shadow of the poetry, a consequence of the poetry. It succeeds poetry. It does not precede it. There was no poet before. There was no mother before. There was a man, there was a woman, but there was no poet, there was no mother. The mother comes in existence after the poetry has happened. But ordinarily, whatsoever you call poetry is not poetry. It is just a mind thing. You think it, you write it. Whatsoever you write is prose. Whatsoever God writes through you is poetry. It may have the form of prose. It doesn't matter. Whatsoever Buddha says, Jesus says, is poetry. The form is prose. That is not the point. But because God writes it, the whole writes it through the part. The ocean tries to give you a message through the drop. Whenever you write, it is prose, ordinary prose. Whenever God writes through you, it is poetry. It may be prose, it is still poetry. You cannot be identified with being a poet. That will be a disturbance. That will destroy the whole music and the whole harmony. So it is good that the identification is dropped. Good that you have forgotten about poetry. Good that now it doesn't seem in any way to affect you whether you write or not. This is the right situation. Now for the first time there is a possibility poetry may happen. I cannot say it will happen, because poetry cannot be predicted. If you predict it, again the mind will start functioning and waiting and trying and doing something about it. No, you completely forget about it. It may take months. It may take years. It may take your whole life. But someday, if you have really forgotten completely your identification, you will become the medium. Something will flow through you. It will come through you, but it will be of the beyond. Then you will be a watcher, a witness to it. You won't be a poet. You will be a witness. And when it is born, a different quality of being will come in its wake. That's what a poet is. All great poets are humble. They don't claim. Upanishads are not signed. Nobody knows who wrote them. The greatest of poetry, even the poets have not tried to sign it. They have not left their signatures. That would have been profane. They have left it. They have not claimed. They were just vehicles. A real poet is a vehicle, a medium. That's why I praise poetry so much, because it is very close to meditation, very close to religion, the closest neighbor. The politician works with the practical. The scientist with the possible. The poet with the probable. And the mystic with the impossible. The probable is the closest neighbor of the impossible. That's why I praise poetry. But when I praise poetry, I'm not praising your poets. 99% of them are just junk. They are doing a mind thing, an ego trip. They manage, that's all. But the poetry doesn't come through them. You can write a poetry. Technically, it may be correct even. And it may be dead. Sometimes it happens, technically a poetry is not correct. But it is alive. Who bothers whether a thing is technically correct or not? The real thing, whether it is alive or not. If you are going to become a mother, would you like a child technically correct but dead? A plastic child. technically absolutely right. You cannot find a fault. In fact, if you want technically correct human beings, then only plastic beings are possible. Only they can be absolutely correct. A real alive child has so many defects, bound to be so, because life lives in danger and death. Only a dead thing is out of danger. Life is always a hazard. There are 1001 difficulties to be crossed, riddles to be solved. The very phenomena that life exists is a miracle, with so many imperfections. Life is imperfect. Because life is a growing phenomenon, anything that is growing will be imperfect. Otherwise, how it will grow? Anything which is perfect is already dead. It is good for the grave. You cannot do anything else with it. 99% of your poets are just junk. They give birth to dead children. Sometimes, and only sometimes, rarely, a poet is there. And whenever such a phenomenon exists as the poet, which is a miracle on the earth, just next to the mystic, one step more, he will become a mystic. If the poet tries a little more to be on his wings, he will become a mystic. If the mystic, in his compassion, descends a step towards you, he will become a poet. Poetry is a communication of the mystery of life. Unless you have felt it, how can you communicate? Poetry is a relationship between you and the whole. Something transpires between the drop and the ocean, between the leaf and the tree. Something transpires between the whole and the part, and the part starts dancing, and the part is so overflowing with joy that it sings, so delighted that its movements become poetic. It no more walks on the earth, it flies. Prose is just walking on the earth. Poetry is a flight into the sky. Prose is just walking. Poetry is dancing. The movements are the same, but the quality is tremendously different. Good, blessed you are if the identification is gone. And that's what I am trying through sannyas, so that your old identification is gone and you are left in a vacuum. Only in the vacuum the hands of God can descend in you and create something out of the mud that you are. Create something beautiful that will not be yours. It will come through you. Rejoice that the identification is gone. Don't try to bring it back. Forget all about it. Forget all about that you know. in relation to poetry, poetics. Forget everything. You just rejoice in being yourself. One day, suddenly, you will fall in line with the whole. A turning in, a tuning in. And a song descends like a dove. And then you will be, for the first time, a poet. You will not claim it, but you will be. Those who are, they don't claim. Those who are not, only they claim. The third question, I feel as an actor in a play, and I don't always like my role in it. Just when I feel it is dropping, you push me back into it, defining me. It appears you give me a form while my being is bursting at the seams. I want to explode and spread. Why do you mold me so? The first thing, if you really feel that you are an actor in a play, then there is no question of your like or dislike. Then you cannot say that I sometimes don't like my role in it. Because like and dislike come only when you think yourself not as an actor, but as a doer. To the actor, all roles are the same. Whether in drama you become Jesus or Judas, what difference does it make? If you really know that this is a drama, and Judas and Jesus's are all the same behind the curtain, beyond the stage, it is just an act. What is wrong in being a Judas? How can you dislike it? And what is good in being Jesus? How can you like it? The like and dislike exists only when you think you are the doer. Then good and bad come in. Then judgment, valuation. Then condemnation, appreciation. Then the duality enters. Only with the doer, the duality enters. If you are an actor, it is all the same, whether you are a Judas or a Jesus. Once you understand the point that life is just a great drama, finished with likes and dislikes, then whatsoever the whole wills, you do it. You are not the doer. You fulfill the desire of the whole. That is one of the greatest teachings of all religions. To become an actor in life, then like, dislike disappear. When like, dislike disappear, choice disappears. And when you are choiceless, you are free. The moksha, the nirvana is attained. Become an actor. Play the role. Play it beautifully. Because when one has to play it, why not play it beautifully? You are a Judas, perfectly okay. Be a Judas. Enjoy the role. And let the audience also enjoy the role. Behind the stage, Judas and Jesus are meeting and having tea. There are friends there. They have to be. In fact, without Judas, Jesus cannot be. Something in the story will be missing. Something very essential will be missing. Just think of Jesus without Judas. Christianity will not be possible. There may not have been any record of Jesus without Judas. Because he betrayed, Jesus was crucified. Because Jesus was crucified, the event struck hard in the heart of humanity. Christianity is born not of because Christ, but because of the cross. So I prefer that Christianity should be called Crossianity. It should not be connected with Christ, but with cross. And you go and see in the church, you will see cross raised higher than Jesus. And the bishops and the popes wearing cross. It is born out of cross. But if you think that, then who is the author of this crucifixion? Judas, not Jesus. And at the last moment, on the cross, just before he died, he hesitated. The part hesitated to dissolve into the whole. The river hesitated to fall into the ocean. It's natural. It is human. Jesus is Son of Man and Son of God. Every river must be tremendously apprehensive and afraid when it comes to the ocean. It was coming all the way. It may have journeys thousands of miles to meet the ocean. But whenever the river falls into the ocean, a deep turmoil is bound to be there in the heart. Sea is going to disappear. The ocean is so vast. Where sea will be? Sea will be lost. Her identity gone. The name, the form, the dreams, the desires, all gone. And the ocean is so vast. Sea will simply disappear. Falling into the ocean, it is death. There is the cross. When a river falls into the ocean, there is a cross. Jesus, at the last moment, looked at the sky and said, God, have you forsaken me? Why this is happening to me? A deep cry of anguish. Why have you forsaken me? So is the humanity of Jesus. And that is where Jesus is tremendously beautiful, incomparably beautiful. Buddha is more inhuman. You may call it superhuman, but he is inhuman. If he was going to die on the cross, he would not have cried towards the sky, why you have forsaken me? He knows there is nobody to cry to. He knows no God exists. That is all human foolishness. And he knows all that is born is going to die. He has understood it totally. He will not cry. He will simply dissolve. The river of Buddha will not hesitate. It will not hesitate for a single moment. There will not be a cross. Buddha is inhuman. Very far away from the human heart. Mahavir is still even more inhuman. They are not of this world at all. They are very abstract, as if they are not concrete human beings. They look more like ideas, unembodied. Fictitious they look, mythological they look, but not real. Jesus is very real. He is as real as you are. And this cry, Buddha must have laughed. If he was there, he would have laughed that this man is foolish. What are you crying? To whom are you crying? In Lewis Carroll's beautiful book, Alice in Wonderland, there is a small dialogue. Tweedledum says to Alice that, for what are you crying? You are unreal. Just a dream of the king. Elias looks at him and said, but I am real. Tweedledum laughs and says, you are foolish. If he, the king, stops dreaming, where you will be? Alice says, of course, I will be here. Tweedledum laughs again and says, you fool, if he stops dreaming, you will simply disappear. You are a figment of his dream. Don't cry. How can you cry? You are unreal. Alice goes on crying and sees, if I am unreal, then who is crying? If I am unreal, then what about these tears? Tweedledum says, you fool, you think these tears are real? Are your crying is real? Buddha would have laughed. Shankara would have laughed. What are you doing? This whole world is Maya, the dream of the king. You are just part, a figment of it. You are not real. You are unreal. Disappear. Why you are saying you have forsaken me? Who is there to forsake you? But not Jesus. He cries. Tears may have flowed through his eyes. He is human. As human as you are, rooted in the earth as you are, he is very earthly. But not just earthly, just not mere earthly, he is more. He cried. For a moment he became even angry and annoyed. And he said, what are you doing to me? Have you forsaken me? And then he understood. The river agitated, then understood, then moved into the ocean. Then he said, I understand. Thy will should be done, not mine. The part ready to fall into the whole. He is earthly, he is heavenly both. He is a great bridge. At the last moment, he understood the whole thing as just a role to be played. Thy will should be done, not mine. Then it becomes acting. If it is your will, then it is doing. This is the difference. You ask me, I feel as an actor in a play. You must be thinking as an actor in the play. Because the next part of the sentence denies it. And I don't always like my role in it. If it is just a play, then why bother? Be a Judas or be a Jesus, it is all the same. From where the valuation comes of like and dislike. The ego exists in your likes and dislikes. In your choice exists the ego. When you don't choose, the ego disappears. That is what I am doing to you. Just when I feel it is dropping, you push me back into it. Yes, I will go on pushing you until the choice disappears completely. Don't resist me. Because if you resist, then you will not be able to understand for long. Don't get annoyed and don't say, what are you doing to me? It appears you give me a form while my being is bursting at the seams. I want to explode and spread. That I want is the barrier to explode and to spread. The I cannot explode and cannot spread. It can only think. It can dream. My whole effort is so that you can drop the I and just be. Then you will spread. Then there will be no barrier for you. Then you can become infinite. You are infinite. The ego won't allow you to see it. The ego won't allow you to see the truth. Why do you mold me so? I will go on molding you from one form to another, again from one form to another, so that you can understand that you are formless. Only the formless can be molded into form. If you have a form, then you cannot be molded into another form. You are already fixed. If you want to mold steel, it will be difficult. You can mold mud easily. Why? Why not steel? Steel has a more fixed form. You can say in this way, steel believes in a more fixed form. The steel is deceived by a more fixed form. The mud is not so much deceived. Then there is water. Formless, fluid. You put it in a jar and takes that form. You move it into another jar. Never for a single moment it rests. It takes another form. It is fluid. Allow me to mold you in many forms. Because only changing from one form to another, somewhere in between, you will become aware of the formless. There is no other way to become aware of the formless. Moving from one form to another, just in the middle somewhere, when the old form is gone and the new has not arisen, in that interval, someday you will become aware. That's what God Himself is doing. Goes on changing your forms. Sometimes you were a plant, then you were a bird, then you became an animal, then you became a man, sometimes a woman, sometimes a man, sometimes black, sometimes white. Sometimes stupid, sometimes intelligent. He goes on changing your form. Because that is the only opportunity. Changing the form somewhere in the middle, one day you will become aware. And then The whole thing is an acting. Then you will be able to say, thy will should be done, not mine. That moment you are freed. When you can say with your whole heart, thy will should be done, not mine, you have disappeared. The river has fallen. The fourth question, I feel that I have been dishonest and insincere in all my relations throughout my life. Yes, sir, I have not done justice with my parents, nor with my wife, nor with my children, nor with my friends and neighbors and so on. And now I feel I am not just and sincere to my master and my sannyas also. This is cause of great agony to me, to my mind. What should I do? If you start thinking in terms of doing, you will again be insincere. Because whatsoever you have done, you have been insincere. Your doing has become corrupted. So the first thing is, resist doing. Just remain alert of your insincerity. Don't be in a haste to do anything, because that will be done again by you. Your whole past will be involved in your doing. Resist. Just remain with this feeling that you have been insincere. That's enough. That is purifying. It has a tremendous capacity to purify and cleanse you. Just remain with the feeling that I have been insincere, that I am insincere, and don't try to do anything about it, because that is again trying to make a good image of yourself, that you are not insincere, you are a sincere man. Your ego is hurting that you have been insincere. Try to be aware of the fact. Don't try to do anything about it. Anything you do will be immature and too early. You just remain with the idea, live with it. Live with the idea that you are insincere. If you can live with it, the very idea, the very awareness will kill your ego completely. Because the ego cannot remain alive if you think you are insincere. The ego needs a good image that you are a sincere man, very honest. That's what the ego is saying you. Do something. So you can repaint the image, renovate the image. You have been insincere. This has been revealed through meditation. Now the ego is in danger of death. The ego says, do something. Through doing, it will try to again reclaim the fallen image, resettle with the old. So you can feel again that I am good, I am beautiful, I am sincere, I am moral, I am this and that. First thing, very difficult, arduous, but this has to be done. Just remain alert of the insincerity. Live with the idea and don't be bothered to change it. It will change on its own accord. Because once you understand you are insincere, you cannot remain insincere. It is impossible. It has never happened. It cannot happen. The very thing is impossible. If you know that you are insincere, it will drop. If you want it to save, then do something to create the feeling that you are sincere. If you know that you are a liar, the lying will stop by its own accord. If you feel you are immoral, Don't try to do anything. Don't repent. Don't feel guilty. Those are tricks. Remain with the idea, the naked fact, who you are. Don't move. Don't get occupied in doing something. Remain naked with the naked idea, the naked reality. And you will see a change is happening, not by your doing. And when a change comes to you, not by your doing, it comes from God. And only God can make you moral, sincere. Only God can make you religious. Only God can make you pure. It is prasad. It is His gift. You cannot do it. All your doing will be undoing. Please remind yourself again and again that you are not to do anything. And you say, this is cause of great agony to my mind. Yes, it is a great cause to agony to your mind and to the ego, which is the same, mind or ego. Because the ego feels hurt, you and so insincere, and you had always believed that you are a very sincere man. You had always believed that you are a pinnacle of man, a crescendo of humanity, purest gold. You had always believed that. Now meditation has broken a window into the falseness. You have been able to look into yourself, the reality. You have come across a mirror. Now don't try to escape from it. Remain with the fact. Whosoever you are, that is your reality. Remain with the fact. If you can remain with the fact, you will change. But that change will not be your doing. It will happen. And when a transformation comes to you, it has a totally different grace. Whatsoever you do will always be tiny, mediocre, and finally useless. Whatsoever God does to you is infinite. Only that can be infinite which comes from the infinite. Don't try to do anything. Accept the fact. Remain with it. Relax. And suddenly there will come a transformation. I teach sudden transformation. And I teach transformation by God, not by you. You are just to allow Him. That is all that you have to do on your part. Open the door. Wait. Just open the door. That much you have to do. Allow. So that when He knocks at the door, you can welcome Him. When He comes, you can recognize Him. When He comes, you can call Him in. Just don't sit with closed doors, that's all. And meditation is nothing but that, opening the door. Meditation will not give you enlightenment. Remember, no technique can ever give you enlightenment. Enlightenment is not technical. Meditation can only prepare the ground. Meditation can only open the door. Meditation can only do something negatively. The positive will come. Once you are ready, it always comes. Please don't try to do anything, just be. The fifth question, you said that the family is the first thing to renounce. I don't understand why we were served prasad on the day of your father's initiation. The family has to be renounced. That's true. I have renounced my family, but my family is rare. They have not renounced me. And it is rare, I say, because it has not happened before. Jesus' father never came to Jesus to be initiated. John Baptist initiated many, but his own father never came to be initiated. Krishna's father was not a disciple to him. My father is rare. Not because he is my father, he is simply rare. There was every possibility, as human nature goes, there is every possibility that a father cannot come and bow down to his own son. It's almost humanly impossible. He has done that. You will not find a parallel in the whole history of man. And it may not happen again. But you are blind and you cannot see the fact. So even the prasad became a problem to you. Just think of bowing down to your own son, coming to the feet of your own son, being initiated. A tremendous humbleness. A tremendous innocence is needed. That is one of the most difficult things in human relationship. It is not accidental that Jesus' father never came to him. It is simple to believe in the son to whom you have given the birth, whom you have seen from the very first day, his first cry. How can you believe that he has become enlightened? Your own son? Impossible. Your own blood, bone? Impossible. How can you think that he has become something, someone from whom you have to learn? A son remains a son. And to a father, he remains a child always. Because the distance always is the same. If my father was 20 when I was born, that 20 years distance has remained the same. It will always remain the same. If I am 45, he will be 65. I cannot come closer to him. In age, he will be always 20 years more experienced than me. And to come back to me and to surrender, you cannot realize the significance of it. That's why you ask such foolish questions. It is one of the rarest moments. And I again repeat, my father is rare, not because he is my father. He is simply rare. The sixth question. Jesus became the Christ on the cross or when he came out of the Jordan River? Are there stages of Christhood also? There are no stages. Enlightenment or Christhood or Buddhahood happens in a single split second. There are not gradual stages, but when Jesus was baptized by John the Baptist in the River Jordan, the journey started, not Christhood. The seed started moving towards being a tree. The seed was broken in the soil. Now, the tree and its coming is only a question of time. You cannot say when the seed has broken in the soil that the tree is there. You cannot say, because the tree is not there. You cannot say that the tree is, you cannot say, because where you will see the tree, you cannot rest under the tree, you cannot pluck the fruits, you cannot have the fragrance of the flowers. The tree is non-existential. Yes, in one way you cannot say the tree is, but in another way the tree is, because the seed is broken. The tree is on the way. It is coming. Now it is only a question of time. It has come in a way, because it has started. The day John the Baptist initiated Jesus, the seed was broken. Heavens opened, and the Spirit of God, like a dove, descended. This is the beginning, not of Christhood, beginning towards Christhood. The seed moving towards the tree. Jesus became Christ on the cross when he said, "Thy will be done, not mine." That day he became a tree. He became a big, vast tree. Thousands can take shelter under him now. It bloomed. It filled the whole earth with fragrance. So in a way, you can say that on the Jordan, when he was initiated, the first glimpse was achieved. On the cross, the last. It depends how you want to express it. But I think I have conveyed the meaning to you. He started on the journey towards being a Christ on that day. You can call him Christ also on that day. It is just a question of how to express it. But my emphasis is that he moved towards Christhood. He became Christ on the cross. Christhood or Buddhahood or Nirvana, Moksha, enlightenment, they happen in a split second. They have no gradualness about them. They are sudden transformations. The seventh question, the return is entirely a personal affair. Even a very near one cannot understand. It is actually easily possible only for those who have suffered. But Lord, you are calling all. Is it possible for them to hear you call, your call of love? That is not the point. Whether they hear it or not, that is not the point. I should go on calling. They may be deaf, but I am not dumb. If they don't listen, I will have to call more loudly, that's all. And when you call 1,000, 100 only will listen. And one can never know who will be the 100. You call 1,000, 100 will listen. The very nature of call is such that only those who are just near awakening can listen it. Only those whose sleep is almost complete, who are nearing the morning and are getting ready to wake, only those who can listen. But you cannot see who will be those. Call 1,000, 100 will listen, and only 10 will start moving. 90 will listen and still will not move. They will listen, but they will not understand. Or they will understand something else. Or they will misunderstand. 10 will start moving. And when 10 move, only one reaches. 9 will be lost on the way. Call 1,000 and you have called only one. But this is how things are. So one has to go on calling. So I don't bother a bit whether you listen or not. I go on calling. One is bound to come. And that's enough. If you call 1,000 and one comes, if you call 10,000 and 10 come, that's enough. One should not ask for more. That is already too much. This is right, that only those who have suffered will be able to understand me. Because pain purifies. Suffering gives understanding. Suffering gives a certain crystallization. Unless you suffer, you don't know what life is. Unless you suffer, you don't know how difficult it is to get out of life. I was reading the life of a great Japanese poet, Isa. He suffered. And he must have been a very, very sensitive man. He was a great poet. He is one of the greatest haiku poets. Just when he was 30, he had already lost his 5 children. 5 children died. Just when he was 30. Almost every year, a child was dying. And then his wife died. He was almost completely mad, in anguish, in suffering. He went to a Zen master. The Zen master asked, "What is the problem?" The Zen master must have been almost like a Buddha, not like Jesus. One who has attained, but one who has completely forgotten human misery. Isa said that my 5 children are dead and now my wife is dead. Why there is so much suffering? I can't see the reason for it. What is the explanation? I have not done anything wrong to anybody. I have lived as innocently as possible. In fact, I have lived very aloof. I am not much related to people. I am a poet. I live in my own world. I have not done anything wrong to anybody. I have lived a very poor life, but I was happy. Now suddenly my 5 children are gone, my wife also gone. Why there is so much suffering and for no reason? There must be an explanation. The Zen master said, "Life is just like a dew drop in the morning. It is the nature of life that death happens. There is no explanation. It is the nature of life. There is no need for any special reason to be given. Life's nature is like dew drop. It hangs for a while on a leaf of grass. A small breeze and it is gone. The sun arises and it evaporates. That's the nature of life. Remember that." Isa was a man of deep intelligence. He understood it. He came back. He wrote a haiku. The haiku means the life a dewdrop. Yes, I understand. The life is a dewdrop. Yet and yet. In that yet and yet, he's saying something superbly human. Life is a dewdrop, I understand. And yet, the wife is gone, the children are gone, and the eyes are full of tears. And yet, yes, life is a dewdrop, but, and that but is great. Only those who have suffered, they can understand that life is a dewdrop. And even then, yet and yet remains. Even then, even when you understand, understanding is difficult. And those who have not suffered, what to say of them? They live a superficial life. Happiness is always superficial. It has no depth in it. Only sadness has depth. Life is superficial. Only death has depth. Life is very ordinary. Eating, earning, loving. Very ordinary. Suffering has a depth. It awakes. It sucks you out of your sleep. Yes, only those who have suffered will understand what I am saying. And yet, even they may not understand. But this is so. This is how life is. If one becomes, because of this, despondent, and thinks not to call, not to say anything. It happened when Buddha became enlightened. For 7 days he remained silent. He thought, who will listen? He thought that what I am going to say, who will understand? He thought the things that have happened to me, if somebody had told them to me when they had not happened to me, even I would not have understood. So who will understand? So why bother? For 7 days he sat under the Bodhi tree. Tradition says the devas in the heaven became very disturbed. Why he is keeping quiet? After thousands of years, one becomes enlightened. Why he is not calling people? They came. A beautiful story. They bowed down to Buddha and they said, you should say something. You have attained. You should give the call. The word should spread to people. Why are you keeping quiet? We waited and waited, and 7 days looked like 7 centuries. What are you doing? Don't waste time. You are only for a little while more, and then you will disappear forever and ever. Before you disappear, give a call. Buddha said, who will listen? Who will understand? But those devas were very cunning, and it is good that they were cunning. They are good. They persuaded. They said, yes, you are right. Where rare is the possibility of someone's listening, and rarest is the possibility of someone's understanding. But it is there. Call 1,000, 100 will listen. 90 will not understand. 10 will walk. 9 will be lost on the way. Somewhere or other they will think that they have achieved. And they will sit by the side and will think that they have come home. Only one will arrive. But one is more than enough. And Buddha understood. And he started preaching. I know it is a very hopeless effort. Knowing well you will not understand, I go on talking to you. It is as if one is talking to walls. When Bodhidharma became enlightened, he was sitting near a ball, back to the wall. But immediately he turned. He faced the wall. And for 9 years, he will not sit in any other way. Whenever he will sit, he will face the wall. If somebody was there, inquirer, seeker, he will have to ask the questions from the back. And people will ask, what foolish posture you have chosen. Many Buddhas have been in the world, but nobody has been facing the wall. Why you sit in this way? Why you are so crazy? And Bodhidharma will say, as far as I know, all the Buddhas have been facing walls. Because wherever you look, there is a wall. That's not the point. Bodhidharma will say, they all have faced walls, but they were a little more polite. He will say, I am not so polite. That's all. I don't bother a bit what you think of me. I will turn only my face towards you when I will see that someone is there who can understand me. For 9 years, he faced the wall, then came one man. And the man said, turn towards me, otherwise I will kill myself. He was having a sword in his hand, but still Bodhidharma won't turn. He cut his hand and said, look, the hand is gone. Now the second thing will be had. Then Bodhidharma turned. He said, wait, so you have come. Because only those who are ready to behead themselves, they can understand. Enough for today.